Welcome to the January 2017 monthly podcast for the learning and development professionals of Greater Philadelphia. I'm in the studio here tonight, and I'm your host, John Laskowski, one of the co-founders of L&D Philly. And we're here talking with Ken Blackwell, CEO of Inclaritas, tonight, all around coaching and his personal experience and journey through the L&D world, kind of how it's led him to our monthly event in January, which is all going to be about tricks and tips you can use as ID and learning and development professionals as you're working on your projects. I'm joined here by Joanne Filiberto, our producer from Brookwood Media. Want to give another big shout out, as I do every time we're online, to Brookwood. They've been a great partner for L&D Philadelphia, helping us produce and host our online events, both our webinars as well as these podcasts. So thank you to Brookwood for your continued support. All right. So again, we have in the studio with us tonight Ken Blackwell. Ken's the CEO of Inclaritas. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here.
Ken, I want to start off a little bit about your personal life, so folks who might be attending or thinking about attending the event in January get to know you a little bit. So first question off the bat, kind of the break the ice. Any hobbies, anything you're passionate about besides, of course, your L&D work?
I love to get to CrossFit whenever I can. It's been a little bit of a break here as business has picked up through the fall, but I'm looking to hopefully get back to my CrossFit box as soon as I can. I also enjoy yoga and the martial arts, although it's been a little while for both of those as well. I guess my one go-to hobby that is always around and always available, regardless of what time, is doing some reading. And right now I am slogging through Hamilton by Ron Chernow, that the Broadway show is based on. And Hamilton was just one of those people that, as a history buff, I was always interested in but never really knew anything about. And so the book is amazing. It's fascinating, but it is really dense. So it's a slog, but well worth it.
When you say slog, is it somewhat similar to books put out by David McCullough?
It is that extensive, yes. The amazing amount of research, amazing amount of detail and depth. You really get a sense of who this guy is and what makes him tick and why he did some of the things he did. But it's a thick book. And I'm reading it, electronically. But even so, you watch that percentage of how far you're through the book, and you're like, it really should like change at some point, right? It's been stuck on, 14 or 15% for a while now, right? It is a really amazing read, and also has some interesting lessons for leadership, I think, as I'm getting into it.
Okay. Have you seen the Broadway show yet?
I have not. Would love to.
Yeah, I'm personally a big fan of Broadway, and I don't get up to New York much in the last couple of years, but would love to see the show. And I guess based on your recommendation, might have to read the book, but I've got about 30 or 40 on my shelf at this point, so I really need to add the collection. So now, as we're talking about hobbies, I know that you have a background in photography. Any of the skills associated with the photography field that you've been able to kind of transfer over the years into the work that you do in L&D?
Well, yeah, the working as a commercial photographer, for a variety of studios in New Jersey, one of the things that you learn fairly quickly is that the thing that you do, you actually don't do most of the time. So in the case of photography, really you're only maybe shooting 10 or 15% of the time. The rest of the time you're doing something else. And I think the same is true for being an L&D professional. There's the amount of platform time we have when we're actually in front of a class, doing that thing. And then many times we're doing a lot of the other background stuff. As a solo entrepreneur, learning, early on some of the things you need to do in terms of sales and marketing was really, really helpful. But working with clients, one of the things I found that was the most important skill to have as a photographer, because we were doing, commercial photography, so it was a lot of product work, a lot of catalog work, occasionally actually working with some people. Most of the time it was computers and boxes and machines that we were photographing. Being able to help a client see the end product, and see it perhaps visually, with a sketch, or a Polaroid. Most often, though, see it verbally. to actually imagine what that thing's going to look like when it finally gets lit. Because back in the day that I was working in photography, we didn't have digital photography. We didn't have instantaneous imaging. We had to shoot film. We had to, either send it out for a process or bring it upstairs to the machine. And it would take, a couple hours to actually see the end product. But, as you're starting to set up, put a set together, start to do lighting, to be able to help that client see where their vision was going to lead, to see what that picture was going to be, has actually helped me in my work, in L&D, helping people see what an outcome might be, and kind of that verbal ability to translate things into a vision that they can, connect with, that they can see, like, oh, okay, yeah, I see where that's going. Perhaps disagree with, but at least be able to see that visual of what the future might look like, has been a really important skill that I've carried with me.
Awesome. Yeah, being a high school teacher, I can relate, or the thing that you do isn't actually what you do most of the time. So, being in front of a classroom even 5 periods a day, you don't necessarily spend actually the majority of your time in a given week. Your lesson planning, you're calling parents, you're grading, you're researching, you're doing, long-term planning. So, you might be, let's say, 20 hours a week in front of the kids. Another 20, 30, 40 is actually spent, kind of getting ready for or following up from what just happened today. So definitely can agree and understand that perspective. So I don't want to delve into your career a little bit without kind of laying the groundwork. I mean, as I said to you in our pre-show conversation, I absolutely love your tagline. If you go to Ken's LinkedIn profile, if you're listening to us, go check out Ken Blackwell on LinkedIn. And as soon as you see his tagline, you, I think, will have to agree with me. It is the best tagline I've ever come across from an L&D professional. So, Ken, you want to share that with everybody?
Sure. My tagline is that I rescue accidental leaders and dysfunctional teams. And,
Oh,
you know,
I'm
it's
still blushing.
it's interesting because, so much of it is true for me, really. I think of myself in some ways as an accidental leader. I did not set off in my career to be, in the L&D field, to do training. It was actually when I was in school learning photography that I got exposed to what I now know to be team building. One of my student jobs was working in the outdoor experiential education program there at RIT. And, we did ropes courses and rock climbing, canoe trips, and it was a fantastic, really fun, student job. And I did not realize until much later that I was learning how to facilitate and how to do team building. And it was something that then, when I bumped into a company that was doing similar stuff back here in New Jersey, I said, hey, maybe I'll start doing that. So I was ended up freelancing a bit from one to the other. So, as with many people, we don't start off at 8 years old thinking, oh, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do, and actually follow through on that path. Things happen, and we end up places that maybe we didn't intend. And so that's, sort of one definition of the accidental leader is somebody who's a leader, they're running an organization or department, had no real intention of being there, but they're there. And so now what do they do? Oh my goodness.
So you talked about team building. So did you actually start out mainly focused on team building and leadership development, or were you doing other things in the L&D space in addition to that, or before you got into like full-time team building in the L&D world?
If I make the line for my, professional adult world and kind of separate out what I did in college, yeah, what I started off doing was actually doing, team building. It was exclusively ropes courses. The company I was working for was sort of an outward bound-ish kind of company. They did a lot of nonprofits, a lot of schools. Put a number of youngsters up through a ropes course. Can't tell you how many people, and some corporate groups as well. And then, sort of as you work your way up through the ranks, you get out of the school programs and more into the corporate groups. But started off just being, yeah, a very hardcore team building ropes course. Get out in the woods. Use the 2x4s and the cinder blocks to run people through activities. That was the core of what I started doing, and then everything else really kind of developed out of that. The next company I worked for had the idea that, it's kind of nasty weather here most of the year here in New Jersey. So let's develop some of these activities that we can do inside, so that we have, programs all year round. And so that then started to bring us into the classroom and started to bring me into the classroom. That then finally led to doing other things and other things and other things. So it's, yeah, kind of a progression. But I started off just being, a hardcore ropes course team building facilitator.
So I want to delve into that, in terms of how you discovered your niche. So, you mentioned a lot about team building and the activities there. Was there an inkling early on as you were working with those team building activities that there was a need for leadership for folks who maybe don't have a background or didn't have the intent on being a leader? Or was that something that kind of just slowly started to emerge, or did you have like a light bulb moment at some point?
Really, a very dawning evolution, I think. Oftentimes when you're working with a team, you inevitably realize that it's not just the team that needs some work, it's often the leader as well. They're in medicine, they talk about things being comorbid, and one kind of affecting the other. And so often, teamwork is a result of the leadership present, and leadership is a result of the team that's present. And so they do kind of feed and bounce back and forth off each other. So it's been a growing evolution of thought. It was never an aha moment that I had, as much as a kind of a, yeah, this just seems to always be the case. And the more experience you get and the longer you go, the more you realize, yeah, this is really the thing here. And there's no avoiding it, right? So every time they do studies, they talk about how much of an organization's culture and character come down from the top. There's talk about 60 some percent of an organization's culture is derived directly from those in leadership. And that's very true at the team level as well, that the team leader is the one who's often driving that character. So, as I was looking at what I'm going to be doing here as I move out on my own, really seemed like I needed to do both. I really actually had the intention of focusing more on the coaching side of the business. That's really what I had a lot of enjoyment doing, was doing the executive coaching work that I'd done. And I realized fairly quickly that, I just can't divorce it because these things do exist together, and I've got to have both the team and the leadership component together.
So if I was a CEO or maybe a vice president somewhere in a large organization, and I came across you or I, crossed paths with you at some point, what would you want me to know right off the bat in terms of, I have, let's say, a leader on my team. They lead, one of my sub teams, maybe 10 people, maybe 20 people. From your experience working with, a diverse set of clients, what's one thing that you want them to know right up front that is critical to the success of the type of work that you do?
Well, we live in a thought economy, really, right? We've moved from the information economy to, I think, a thinking economy, or sometimes people refer to it as a purpose economy, but a thinking economy. And so much of what we do these days is based on thinking. And it's really based in the work that happens between our ears. We're not making things as much as we used to. There's not the manual labor out there. There's a lot of thought work that happens, and whether that's on a computer or on a piece of paper or just between people, there's a lot of thinking that goes on. And to be able to bring out the best of that thinking in your people really requires some people skills. I think one of the other definitions that I have for the accidental leader is someone who, in this kind of Peter principle, I guess, someone who has gotten elevated into a role because they're really good at something that they do. So oftentimes you have that salesperson who's a great salesperson, so great, they get pushed into the sales manager role, or they're an awesome scientist, so they get made director of the lab. And those leadership roles really are about people. And they fail miserably because they have the technical skills to do the jobs and do the jobs of the people underneath them, but they lack the ability to build relationships. They lack the ability to draw out, to multiply the efforts of their folks by enhancing their thinking and getting the best out of their brains. I mean, that's really what we're talking about, is leveraging people's brain power. So being able to have that skill is critically important. And I think what people still to this day overlook is that people factor. I work a lot with manufacturing organizations, and they're very focused on process, they're very focused on product and the skills you need to produce both of those. and they fall down when it comes to the people side of the equation. And that's that third leg. If you watch Marcus Lemonis, he always talks about people, process, and product, right? So having that people side of the skill equation is critically important, and it's often overlooked. And I think you could take somebody who maybe doesn't have the skills, maybe even doesn't have the business smarts, but if they have the people skills, they can be incredibly successful. So I think we need to rebalance how we're looking at talent, how we're looking at the skills we want to have in our leaders, and really what's necessary. I think we're working still with a very industrial economy mindset. You know, it's all about the skills. It's all about how to do the things and less about how to really manage people.
Okay. Wow. You just hit several topics that I wanted to touch on with you. Let's try and go through them systematically. So going back to what you described as, you know, very often you see how people have very good skill sets. You know, a salesperson gets promoted into a sales manager, you know, scientist gets promoted to lab director. Do you think that kind of thinking is, or those problems are systemic due to maybe just the way businesses are run today? Do you think it's a cultural factor? Do you think that's maybe it is? It's just the nature of the world. Because you mentioned, like, you know, industrial thinking. So often I believe that's how we think still today about education on every level, from K-12 through higher ed to even corporate training. We think so much in terms that were set by learning professionals, teachers, thought leaders 100, 150 years ago. So, I mean, you know, going back to those people who become accidental leaders, do you think it's systemic, cultural, some combination thereof?
Well, I guess it's all of the above, right? We have outrun, technologically, we've outrun ourselves. We haven't caught up, and I think education's a great arena where we can see where the system that we have is one that is easily 100, 150 years old in terms of its makeup, and it doesn't serve us now. It's not giving us the graduates that we need who have the skills they need to actually really be successful. They've got to try and pick that up as they go. And there's a lot of struggle because of that we're just not reaching a lot of kids because of the way in which we're teaching them. I think my 21-year-old daughter had that experience going through the local public schools, and she's a really bright, intelligent kid who just did not get along with the educational system. She loves to learn, and she couldn't where she was because of how she was being taught. And I think that's kind of at the crux of all of this, right? We need to really rethink how we're reaching out to people. From an L&D standpoint, you know, we have this technological capacity now that allows the learner really to drive things. I was at a recent gathering, and a local CEO, was talking to a bunch of us L&D professionals, and he reached over, grabbed somebody's, you know, iPhone off the table and said, listen, you know, like, everything that you guys can teach, I can get through this phone. You know, so what is it you bring different? You know, like, I can get to experts here. I can get to any piece of knowledge practically that is out there. It's available on this little device. So, you know, what's new? What's different? What's the value you bring? And it was a real challenge. And I've heard that from, you know, your CEO or your head of learning and development at Comcast. She said the same thing. You know, what is it that they and we all as learning and development professionals can give that beats the smartphone? We have to be a lot more responsive to learners and the way they learn, allow them to direct and drive a lot of the process. And that's difficult because now we have to really open things up. We have this mindset of moving linearly through a topic when we need to open it up and allow somebody to start at the back and work their way forward instead of just always forward to back or jump in the middle and jump around randomly. That requires a whole other way of thinking about the world, thinking about problems. So, you know, it's a huge challenge, and it's not just in any one company or any one industry. It's not just in the U.S. It's really everywhere. And we'll get there, but we're not there yet.
You mentioned processes and kind of the challenge that we have in the L&D space nowadays. What are your thoughts on, you know, you used the word knowledge, and that example you gave of the CEO who challenged you to say knowledge. Now, and I guess I want to frame the question this way. As much as we might have to change in the L&D space, would you agree that there also needs to be a change inside of the business world? And I'll give you a concrete example. So I'm a very big fan of and read a lot and study around proper onboarding, proper new hire. And so often you see people, start jobs and they fail miserably. Or, ramping up instead of taking 3 months takes 12 months because they're not given kind of a structured, disciplined onboarding program. I mean, you see that across the board. And it ties into, I think, your point earlier about the educational system and how we're not preparing people for, today's workforce or the business world today, the same way they might have been set up 50, 60, 100 years ago. So, do you think it's also a question of the business having to change? And realize that learning still hasn't changed the way, the way people learn hasn't changed in the last 100, 150 years or 1,000 years. It needs to be much more of a consideration for the process of learning as opposed to just seeing everything as discrete events.
Yeah, and I think onboarding is a really great concrete example of this. So, to your last point there, I think what we have been forcing people to do for hundreds of years is to bend themselves to the educational system. And so now we've got to flex it back the other way and bend the learning system to the individual, to the learner. With onboarding, so often it's an event, it's a couple of days, and it is filled with the tactile and tangible. Here's your computer login. Here's your computer. Here's your email. Here's your book that's going to explain all your benefits. It's all the tactical stuff. And I think what many organizations are missing is the cultural component. That piece that really helps bring people into an organization and helps them feel engaged and connected to. Now, there are some shining examples. There are places where you have senior leaders, for instance, coming in and speaking to groups of new hires. And I think that's fantastic to A, show, their interest, their support, but also to share, that bit of the culture, what they see of the organization, where their priorities are, can be critically important. Depending on the size of the organization, the higher up the food chain you can get, the better. But ultimately, it's really about engagement. And the thing about onboarding is that I think we often see that it is thrown to HR. It's an HR thing to do, and it's a discrete event where it really needs to be an ongoing process, one that really doesn't stop and that has continual check-ins. Being able to put people together with some organizational mentors, people who can help them navigate, some of the politics. I think all of those things can really help transform what it is we do in making people successful in their roles. And ultimately, that's, I think, what our job description is as L&D professionals, is to help people be successful. We have to rethink how we're doing things and challenge the business back. They want to put people right to work right away. Okay, super. But if we're losing a lot of people along the way, ultimately, we're not making money there. We're not being successful. We're not being productive. It's not efficient. So we need to rethink how we're bringing people on board so that they can ultimately be successful. And that feeds back into even the recruiting process. Like one, if one assumes that all the recruits coming in are perfect, okay, then we can look at our onboarding as a discrete thing. But many times we have to go back, I think, and ask about the recruiting process and say, so who are we actually bringing in? Are we bringing in the right people? Are we looking just for, knowledge and skills? Or are we also looking for attitude, habits, character, those things that really truly are going to make people successful in the long run?
You bring up a good point there in terms of, I often see L&D as kind of fitting in with those other discrete parts of, the larger HR organizations. So to your point, yeah, if we're not hiring the right people or we don't know what we're hiring for, it often makes training them or coaching them even that more difficult because you're assuming certain things as you're developing programs that may or may not be true because we assume certain things about the characteristics of the people in front of us. So now you mentioned something I think I want to take us back to your work as a coach, as a leadership guru. So we talked about the need for proper onboarding, and I think, really expanding it to, it's not just a discrete event. It's not just, hey, even the new hire training is a week or 3 weeks or 3 months. You need to have those follow-ups, those check-ins, that post-training support. What do you see in terms of leadership today? I mean, I'm not really that clued in to what's going on with leadership development these days. So do you see a lot of the same kinds of trends, or, it's a kind of all over the place, or certain organizations maybe a little bit more smarter and better at doing that than others?
Well, it certainly has gone through some ups and downs the last several years. One of the things that happened with the huge downturn in 08 was that leadership and some of those higher end functions went away, which was really a shock to me. As we were heading into the downturn, I was working in a business that really kind of worked both ends. So it kind of did some higher end work, leadership development, executive coaching 360, as well as some kind of mid-range team building activities to even, sort of fun stuff. So it's really a wide range of, work that they did. And, as we went into the downturn, I thought, okay, well, people are not going to pay for frivolous stuff. Like, we're only going to do the more serious work because people are really going to be concerned about money. Money's tight. And what I found out very quickly was it was exactly the opposite. All of that sort of quote high-end work completely went away. And all the only work that was coming in was sort of like the fun, frivolous stuff. And it took me a long while to kind of get my head wrapped around why that was. And it's because of the investment, the ROI on leadership training. The stats show that it takes, 3 to 5 years really to make your money back. Now, you do make your money back and you make it back in multiples, but it takes a while. And, in the downturn right afterwards, things were so, in such upheaval that many companies didn't even know if they were going to be around in 6 months, 6 months, much less is that executive there going to be there in 6 months. So all of that investment in the long term completely went away. And it was interesting to see, when that started to come back. And it was kind of in late 2011, into 2012 that people started to spend money again in leadership development. So it's something that had gone away and been dormant for a few years. It's now kind of getting back on track, and kind of the first glimmers there in 2012. It's now, I think, much more full guns. People are feeling a lot more comfortable about it, and organizations are doing a lot more work because now they're starting to see the looming other issue that's out there, which is the baby boomers' retirement. So there's now a leadership gap between, the people that have been in leadership roles. People have stayed in them probably a bit longer than they might have otherwise because of the downturn. And now, from a population bubble standpoint, there aren't as many Gen Xers as were baby boomers. And so there's not enough people who have the tenure or have the maturity there in their roles to step in. And that's thrusting a lot of millennials into leadership roles that perhaps they wouldn't have ordinarily been in, we think historically, in terms of just their chronological age anyway. So it's presenting a lot of very interesting challenges for organizations as they have to fill this leadership gap and really start to now ramp up that investment where they had kind of let it go before.
Right there, it's a part of you kind of sitting back, twirling your fingers, going, "Wah, yes, my workload will continue as this trend goes forth." Or are you kind of a little bit cautious in terms of trying to predict the future? I mean, because to your point, you see phenomenon like millennials job hopping so much and not really staying with one company long enough. Yeah, they might build some tertiary skills, but they don't, develop that cultural knowledge of an organization and how it works, or the industry, and kind of what the expectations or the standards are for the industry. I mean, to your point, with the baby boomers set to retire in, in mass in the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, do you see, or are you hope? I'm not hopeful in the sense of, a selfish way, but do you think there's going to be a continued need, an increased need for the type of service that you provide? As more and more people maybe get thrust into leadership roles that either A, they weren't prepared for, or B, they're not maybe qualified for.
Well, there's nothing new under the sun, right? So, leadership development has been around forever, maybe just not under its name, but there's always been a need for, developing the next generation of leadership. And so I don't think it's ever going to go away. I think it'll always be here. It's going to look different, I think. And I think that's a challenge. So how can we do this now? We're starting to maybe finally grow out of this place where people are doing, anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 jobs. One of the consequences of the downturn that I saw was that, people got added additional workload because the headcount went down. And as things got better, the organization said, "Hey, they've been surviving all this time doing two jobs. Let's just kind of keep that going because that's really awesome for us." And it's now hitting a stage of, sort of burnout for folks, and a workload that they're just not able to continue to sustain. And I think that's problematic. So we're going to need to ramp up at some point. I'll get some more folks, but again, we're going to have this demographic bubble to fight at the same time. So it is going to be interesting to see how that happens. The amount of time and resources available to do leadership development is another big question in my mind. People want to do things instantaneously because so much of our world is instantaneous now. So, instead of having the 3-day leadership program or the 2-week leadership program, it's like, what can you do in half a day? Or really, we got 2 hours. Can you fit this in? And wanting to jam in a lot of information or a lot of content very, very shortly. Like with onboarding, though, I think, if you approach it organizationally as a process, and as something you do a little bit continually, I think, you can have a huge multiplier effect from that, and really be able to deliver a huge training distributed over time, right? So I think what happens now is there's nothing, 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 kind of a burst, and then nothing, nothing. And if we can get to a more of a steady drip of training, of developing people, I think that might be a way to really help these organizations grow, because there's so much that people do need to learn, and that just takes time. It's hard to pull people out of the roles for days at a time, really for any training or even, conferences is kind of tough to get away. So if we can find a way to, again, kind of create that steady drip, that more constant development for folks, thinking about, just in time, on the job, developing leaders as coaches, developing leaders as mentors within an organization to help bring those folks up. I think that's maybe one way that we can ultimately be successful, but there's still a lot of challenges out there.
So if I was, again, going back to the proposition I set up earlier, if I was a client and I was approaching you, I've got, somebody on my team managing a group of folks who, maybe is struggling in their new leadership role, what's the number one thing you wish that either people didn't ask you or that they knew up front and only, realized 6 months or 12 months later and they go, wow, I wish I wouldn't have known that up front?
Well, there's lots of those, I think. One might be, that nothing changes overnight, that people take a while to evolve, and there's a light switch mentality. A lot of the senior leaders who are bringing me into organizations, to help fix some of those folks down below, and they just want a light switch thrown and everything to be good, and they want it to happen instantaneously, and people don't change and don't grow that way. Takes time to grow and develop. And then I guess maybe another thing that I wish folks knew or maybe thought about, I guess, is the consequences both of action but also inaction. And I guess I'll focus on the inaction piece here. So many times, bad performance, bad behavior is tolerated, it's allowed. Many times because, that bad behavior is coming from somebody who's really talented in some particular thing. We've probably all worked in an organization where maybe there was like that star sales guy who, really, brought in twice his quota, was really awesome with his numbers, but was a complete jerk to work with, or worse. And yet, that kind of behavior was allowed because, well, he does such a great job with the numbers. Many times that's happening too in organizations with, everywhere from individual contributors to managers, people who are just not pulling their weight. And Again, there's oftentimes not a bench, so you might get to that place where we really need to make a change. We need to, move that supervisor out. They need to find something else to do. Get rid of that manager or that person on the team. But there's nobody to backfill, and so then people, end up kind of lingering because there's no one to replace them, and we just can't, make do with, or we can't live with that person. In terms of the hit we're going to take on production, for instance, or what it's going to mean to another. Well, I'm coaching a plant manager right now who's actually going through this exact scenario. She has two second shift supervisors, and one is completely not pulling his weight, and doing some really basic things like not getting payroll in on time, which has a huge impact on morale, people actually getting paid on their livelihoods, and other things happening that are really having a negative impact on the organization. And she's been kind of slowly working towards, he's got to go. I got to make that move. And she's known it for a long while, but it's just now that she's finally has gotten to that point where, all right, she's taking action, she's doing all the paperwork that she needs to move him on. So in a sense, kind of to have that courage, because many times it's significantly better on the other side. I think we imagine things to be far, far worse on the other side of decisions than they actually are. So we have amazing abilities to imagine, very creative that way. But many times it keeps us from taking action. And so I would love for folks to be in a place where they're willing to take maybe bolder action by comparison onto what they're doing now, but to take action not only for their benefit, but for their people's benefit, for the organization's benefit, and addressing things before they get, before they linger too long.
All right, so you're going to be joining us in person for a workshop next month in January at the Bordentown Library on Saturday, I believe it's the 22nd in the morning, or no, it's the 23rd in the morning. You want to give us
21st,
a
yeah.
little 21st? Okay, there we go, the 21st. You want to give us a little sneak peek in terms of what you'll be talking about and what people can kind of expect in terms of.
Yeah, one of the things I want to do is to share one of my professional interests, which has been neuroscience, and how neuroscience filters back into the world of L&D and into coaching. As I was saying earlier, we're in a thought economy, and so we're only as skillful as our ability to think ourselves and/or leverage the thinking of others. So to understand what in a very simple, non-medical, non-biological way, but to understand some of the simple drivers of human behavior, of why we do things, of what makes people more capable of learning. Taking a look at creative thought, for instance, and why creative thought rarely happens when you're focused on the problem. Creative thought, creative problem solving almost always happens better when you're absolutely doing the opposite of thinking about the problem. You're not thinking about it, which seems counterintuitive. So I'll talk about why that is, and open up the discussion too, and start to bat around some ideas of how to take some of these neuroscience concepts, filter them back into the training that we're designing, the sessions that we're leading, things that would make sense from a brain-friendly standpoint, so that we can get more out of those sessions and get better results for people by doing things that are more friendly for their brain.
And again, as with your company and your day-to-day professional work, we've got a lot of programming set up already for 2017. And again, you've got the best tagline. So you've got something going there. If you ever tire of the whole coaching thing, I think maybe you should go copywriting into the ad world, because you've got it, my friend. You've got the knack for short little blurbs that just want to, entice people. Or at least they entice me.
Well, I mean, and to a certain extent, I think that's one of the skills I have as a coach is in being able to reframe things or repackage things for folks in a different way, right? To capture everything that they've said, but say it in a different way. So kind of really beyond paraphrasing, but kind of in a reframing way that allows them to go, yeah, that's actually what I'm trying to get to, rather than me saying it directly. And we'll talk actually about that. That neuroscience concept and why you can't tell people what to do, why that's actually the worst thing in the world to do. from a neuroscience standpoint. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing folks out there. Hope they all come out, and that'll be an awesome session on the 21st.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank Ken Blackwell, CEO and founder of Inclinitas, for joining us today for our monthly L&D Philadelphia podcast. Ken, appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, John.
All right. And again, we hope to see everybody out on January 21st, Bordentown Library. Program will start at 10 a.m. with breakfast and networking, as always. And we will be talking to everyone soon.